Hello everyone, I'm Viviana Young, the Environmental Education and Outreach Leader for Umpqua Watersheds through United Communities AmeriCorps, and the host of Living Downstream.
Umpqua Watersheds values both human and ecological diversity. We celebrate the strengths and perspectives that different people have to offer and believe that organizations, communities, and ecosystems are all more resilient when they embrace the unique gifts various individuals can contribute. We acknowledge that the land upon which Umpqua Watersheds is located was formerly occupied and tended by various indigenous groups, including Cow Creek Umpqua, Coquille, Molalla, and others. Their history is intertwined with this place, and we seek to continue to practice stewardship and reciprocity towards the natural environment, which indigenous people did for thousands of years prior to European settlement.
For the first part of today's episode, we'll hear a little bit more from Cindy Hawes, who has done much for wetland restoration and surveying, and is the founder of Unleash, Umpqua Natural Leadership Science Hub, which is a nonprofit designed around outdoor environmental education for everyone from elementary school age to those who are attending college. So speaking of college students, you're also a professor at UCC. What do you teach and how long have you been teaching there?
Well, currently I'm just a part-time professor teaching principles of wildlife and fisheries conservation. And I currently am also teaching soil science. I've taught at Umpqua Community College now over, I want to say it's been 11 or 12 years. I didn't realize I'd be there that long. However, I have enjoyed teaching wildlife classes, and occasionally I've taught some of the 100 level biology classes there as well when they have a need.
Do you have a favorite category of study or work, such as geology, hydrology, anything like that?
Yes, my focus and interest is wildlife ecology, and I emphasize the ecology aspect of that. I love wildlife and information and knowledge about wildlife in general, but I really enjoy learning and understanding and sharing information about the habitat of wildlife and the ecological processes and conditions that keep a landscape healthy.
So did you have any influential people in your young life who really encouraged you to go into environmental work?
I wish I could say yes, but that's not the case. That's part of why Unleash exists, because it provides an avenue that didn't exist when I was, and maybe doesn't exist in general. You know, it's kind of rare to find that linkage or connection. Sometimes that happens for some youth in regards to maybe some other outdoor activity they have, and they have an adult mentor who knows things about the outdoors and takes them out there. But that was not the case for me. So no, it was only until I went to college that I started connecting with more mentors when I was actually in the field of wildlife.
Well, thank you for being an influential person in my life. You're actually the person who really got me into conservation work instead of veterinary. You're the one who helped me get into AmeriCorps in the first place. So thank you for being influential.
Well, and that's part of what Unleash wants to do as an organization, is try to link people up that are in this area of interest and see that they find a pathway, because it's not so common, as we know, compared to some of these more traditional things like veterinary science, you know, engineering and such. There seems to be much more ease at finding your way there.
So over the past few years, one of the things that has really impacted education and that entire system was the COVID virus. So how has COVID affected your work and the work of other educators?
It's been very difficult because we have not been able to conduct our youth camp for the last 2 years. And it's also very hard to get financial support because of that. And so, you know, you need to have the funds to have the equipment and the food and the volunteers to help you conduct something like that. And so COVID has made it difficult, even in the outdoor situation, because we're oftentimes in close contact and it was hard to ensure safety. And for me, for example, I have a member of my family who is immunocompromised. And so that adds on to that layer. And of course, even if you don't have a member of your family that might be immunocompromised or might be elderly and highly susceptible to the virus, you can certainly affect somebody else who does. And I certainly wouldn't have wanted to have that kind of an impact on a family. So we were not able to maintain that youth camp program at that time.
So moving on to the topic of wetlands. I've heard the term eutrophication and that it's a problem in our local wetlands. Could you explain what eutrophication is and why it's a problem?
Yeah, eutrophication in water is basically the nutrient enrichment of the water such that it causes these major algae blooms of certain species of algae that then completely change the water chemistry. And so obviously all of these species are tied to the level of oxygen in the water, and eutrophication causes these major fluctuations in the oxygen levels, and then that kills off the species. And then you have a kind of a continuing cycle of more and more of the algae blooms, and it completely alters the entire species composition of a wetland. And in doing so, you actually lose that clean, fresh water that all of us need, including humans, for drinking water.
So in our last interview, we talked a lot about invasive animals. Do we have any invasive plants in our wetlands?
There are invasive plants that are a problem in wetlands and along streams. In the areas where I've been working, we do not have any on public land in the particular wetlands I've been working on. But there certainly are some, like there's purple loosestrife, which is an issue. There's some other very aquatic species that could be an issue that I personally haven't seen. The one species that I've seen that I'm very concerned about from an invasive species standpoint is the Japanese knotweed that is along the streams. I haven't seen that on public land here, though that is possible for that to happen, but I've seen it a lot on private land.
Thank you, Cindy. And that's a good transition to the second part of today's episode, hosted by Director of Education and Outreach for Umpqua Watersheds, Ryan Kincaid.
Our next guest on Living Downstream is Stephen Myers, Taxonomic Director with Oregon Flora. Welcome to the show, Stephen.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Start out, can you tell our listeners a little bit about Oregon Flora? How did it get started and why?
Oregon Flora has been around since 1994, believe it or not. It was started by one man, and for a while it was a one-man operation. It was started by a man named Scott Sundberg, and Scott was a native of Eugene, and he eventually went and got his PhD in botany at the University of Texas, then returned to Oregon in the 90s. And Scott, well, I'm going to call him a visionary. He saw at the time that the state of Oregon did not have a flora or any central warehouse for botanical information. And he, and remember, this was the 90s when the internet, probably before you were born, the internet was in its infancy. And he also foresaw that he could collect as much botanical information as he could and put it online, which again, at the time was like, it seemed crazy. I mean, it's so commonplace today, but now, and he began doing that. And slowly he started adding more people, including myself. And unfortunately, Scott died in 2004 from cancer, but his wife actually took over and she's done a remarkable job of continuing his mission. So his mission had a couple of directions that he wanted to go. The first thing he wanted to do was to and create a new flora for the state of Oregon. There's only been one flora in history for the entire state of Oregon, and that was authored by one man also, a guy named Morton Peck, who was a professor at Willamette University in Salem. And Morton Peck originally published his Flora of Oregon in 1941, and he released a second edition in 1961. So it's a bit dated by now. It's now 61 years old. And in those 61 years, we know a lot more about what's going on in the state of Oregon botanically. Names have changed. Many new plants have been reintroduced. Taxonomy, what plant we're calling what, our concept of what species is what has changed a lot in the past 61 years. His book, you know, I have a copy of it, and I don't use it. It's more of a museum piece to me now, but, you know, he did a remarkable job, and I don't ever want to take anything away from him. And additionally, he was one person. The information in that book was based mainly on his understanding and only his understanding of what was going on in Oregon at the time. And he traveled to every corner of the state looking at plants, collecting plants for his own personal herbarium. And we used to have a map of everywhere he visited in the state. And it was pretty amazing how far he got and the places he visited. But as I just said, he was one person. We have a completely new data set, which relies on literally thousands of people. Currently, there is no up-to-date flora devoted solely to the state of Oregon. You can use floras from other places to kind of cobble together a flora for the state of Oregon. For example, Flora of the Pacific Northwest covers the northern half of the state, but it only comes as far south as about Cottage Grove. So it leaves out the Umpqua Valley in Douglas County, the east side of the state, the high desert, intermountain region. You can use the intermountain flora, which was recently completed. But again, it only covers that side of the state. To the south, you can use the Jepson Manual, which is the flora for the state of California. It's okay for Jackson County, Josephine, Lake County, at least the southern part of Lake County. Again, it doesn't go very far north, though. You might notice an area of the state that's completely left out in these descriptions, which is Douglas County and the Umpqua Valley. That west central part of the state is this botanical black hole, which is a shame because the Umpqua Valley has an amazing flora. I love visiting there. You guys have such an amazing variety of plants. It's a place where several different ecosystems collide. You've got the California floristic province coming up from the south. You've got things leaking over the mountains from the east side. You've got somewhat unique coastal flora, and then things that come in from the north, and they all kind of hit right there in the middle. And so to have that part of the state missing it's not justifiable. Anyway, Scott's mission was to create a new flora for the state of Oregon. And that's what we are in the process of doing. Thus far, we have two volumes of what will eventually be a three-volume compendium flora for the entire state of Oregon. We published the second volume just over a year ago, the first volume a few years before that. We're about halfway done with the second volume. We hope to release that. I'm hesitant to give an exact date as soon as possible, I will say. And once that three-volume set is complete, the state of Oregon will again have an up-to-date flora for the entire state. The strength of our flora, and one of the things Scott insisted on, was that it contained not just dichotomous keys to identify plants, but full and complete plant descriptions. You take something like the flora of the Pacific Northwest, it doesn't have full descriptions. It just has keys, and that's where it ends right there. We have full descriptions of every plant species, subspecies, and variety in the state. And that's why it is so big. That's why it's going to be three volumes. His second mission was to create, as I mentioned earlier, this online presence. And we have a website. It's up and running. It's been up since the early 2000s. And on there, you will find range maps and a photo gallery for every species, subspecies, and variety in the state. And that ties into Scott's third mission, was to collect data. He knew that in order to create a comprehensive flora and a website, that we needed not just data, we needed accurate data. You hear the word big data being thrown around in science circles these days. It's kind of the sexy thing now. There's nothing wrong with big data. Big data is all well and fine, but I like accurate data. And all of us here at Oregon Flora, we insist on accurate data. Data is no good if it's not precise. One of the first things Oregon Flora did starting back in the 90s was to database the herbarium at Oregon State University. Should I explain what an herbarium is? Okay. An herbarium is a collection of plant specimens. And most regions of at least the United States have a good regional herbarium. In the case of the state of Oregon, the biggest and the most comprehensive herbarium in the state is housed at Oregon State University, where Oregon Flora works. We are independent of Oregon State University. We are affiliated with Oregon State University, but we are very independent from them. We don't get any money from them, but they do allow us to work there and use the herbarium. So an herbarium, when botanists go out looking at plants in the field, a good botanist will not just look at the plant and record some data. They will also take samples of that plant and they will press it like you would press a flower in a book to save it for the future. You're just doing that on a bigger scale. You press the entire plant. Most botanists have these elaborate plant presses and you take that pressed plant, which is now dry, and then you glue it to a large sheet of paper and affix a little label to it. And on that label will be the plant's name, when you collected it, who collected it, and other information. Today, it's pretty much the standard. When you collect a plant, you put the latitude and longitude on it. Years ago, they obviously didn't have GPSs. But generally, almost always, the botanists, since they began collecting plants hundreds of years ago, would make these herbarium sheets and put the location and at least the date they collected it. And Oregon State University, their vascular plant collection, which is what we're most concerned with, there's about 250,000 specimens there now. And we have recorded all of that data electronically now. That took a very, very long time. You just can't take a specimen. Well, I've heard there are projects now where they can take a specimen and just load it on this conveyor belt and a machine reads it. That will work if the label is nice and typed out. The Oregon State University Herbarium has a lot of historic collections, and many, many of those labels are handwritten, and a machine simply can't read old-fashioned cursive. So we've done that by hand. Some of the handwriting is really awful. I won't pull any bones there. And in addition, the location data, especially on some of the older specimens, they were towns that don't exist anymore or places that don't exist anymore. And we had to figure out where these things were collected. And even when the location seemed obvious, like this plant was collected behind the post office in Bend. Well, yeah, I can find the post office in Bend today, but in say 1913, it was not where it is now. So we would have to figure out where these locations were so that we could accurately map them. And so that project took many, many, many years to complete. And we finally have it done. And we continue to database specimens as they come in, but they're all typewritten now. And it's a much, much easier task. So that's what I mean by accurate data. Additionally, we have observational data, botanists from PhDs down to just people who are enthusiastic about plants. We'll take anyone's data as long as we believe it's accurate. So we also have observational data in our database too. And currently we have about a million data points that we can map. And then in recent years, we have also taken data from other herbaria. The Oregon State University Herbarium, as you might expect, they concentrate on plants in Oregon. But they also have a lot of plants from neighboring states, Washington, Idaho, Nevada, California. And we've databased a lot of those as well and given them to people doing work similar to what we're doing in other states. And in turn, they've given us their data they have for the state of Oregon. And we also have those dots mapped. So when you look at our maps online, you get a pretty comprehensive range map for that particular plant species. And in addition, we have thousands. I don't know the number off the top of my head, but we have many, many, many thousands of pictures, almost every species in Oregon. We do have a handful that we don't have a picture of. Those tend to be very hard to get to species. Some of them are extinct and you just simply can't take a picture of them now. So there's a handful we don't have a picture of, but for most everything, we do have a picture of it. And most of the time it's a field photo. There's a lot of botanists around who like taking pictures of plants and we're happy about that. And they let us use their pictures, generally royalty free. And we have those displayed online as well. So if anyone is interested in a particular species, where it's growing, what it looks like, we have what we believe to be the best resource for any plant species that grows in Oregon. And I think that about sums up what we're doing currently.
Awesome. Yeah. I was thinking while you were talking, I have so many questions based on different things that you're mentioning. I think first I'll just start with like a definition. Can you explain for our listeners the difference between vascular and non-vascular plants? You mentioned that term.
So vascular plants are the plants that you would normally think about. It's probably easier to define what it is not a vascular plant. A non-vascular plant would be something like mosses, seaweeds, fungi, although they're technically not plants. They're actually more closely related to humans than they are plants, but they would be non-vascular as well. Everything else is a vascular plant.
Yeah, I was thinking back to my teaching years about is like the transport tissue, right? So they're a little bit more complex.
And, you know, a bryologist, somebody who studies mosses, would argue that bryophytes, mosses do have a vascular system, but they're not considered vascular plants. So,
gotcha. Yeah, another thing I was thinking and wondering about, and I don't know if you know the answer to this. So you're mentioning about the herbarium and collecting samples sometimes, but also collecting photographs. Do scientists or people associated with Oregon flora ever collect seeds? Like, is there a seed bank in Oregon or is that not part of what you
do? I'm glad you brought this up because this is a topic we've been talking about more and more. In the past, people typically did not collect seeds. When botanists are out collecting, they generally look for plants when they're in flower. It's usually the way you identify a plant. Not always. There are major exceptions to this, but generally it's easiest to identify a plant by its flower. So when a botanist makes a collection for the herbarium, it's usually when that plant is in flower. Not always. People are realizing, however, more and more that seeds and other parts of the plant are important. There are some groups of plants where the seeds are extremely important. Things like the popcorn flowers. You can't tell one popcorn from another simply by its flower. Its seeds vary drastically from species to species, however. But even in plants where you wouldn't think that the seeds would be important, just gathering more information, people realize we need to do that. So there's a growing number of botanists who will visit a particular site when the plant is flowering and then go back when they know it's going to be producing seeds, when it's in fruit. They'll go back to that location because they know it is that species. They have no doubt of it, and they will collect the seeds. And oftentimes they will attach those to herbarium sheets now. It's not extremely common now, but I'm hopeful that it'll become more common in the future. Additionally, there's other parts of the plant. Historically, if you look, nobody ever collected roots. Mainly, I mean, for very practical reasons, they're dirty. I mean, so nobody wanted to deal with that. I mean, and you know, you think about it. I mean, you were some botanist back in 1920 out in Harney County collecting, You were probably, you know, spending the night in a tent. You didn't want to deal with dirty plant roots. So they would do what we call top snatching. They would just chop off the top of the plant and collect that. Today, we know that root morphology and root anatomy is very important. It's as much a part of the plant as our legs are to us. That one I'm happy to see. Maybe not most, but I think it better be. Most collections in the future should include roots. When I see a collection now that doesn't include roots, it kind of bugs me a little bit, actually. So, and additionally, the data that botanists collect. Again, back in the day, your typical collection would include the plant name, location, and the date, and that was it. Today, you typically always get a more specific location. You not only have a latitude and longitude, but sometimes like actual directions to how to find it. And additionally, other information, the soil type the plant was growing in, what other species were growing around it, any information you can think of. And I'm really, really happy to see that that is, it's not just a style or a trend. It's almost a rule now.
And now for some brief announcements.
Join the Democratic Party of Douglas County and Umpqua Watersheds for a Saving Grace Pet Adoption Center volunteer project. The project is on Saturday, June 4th, beginning at 8:30 a.m. and going till 12 p.m. The location is 450 Old Del Rio Road, Roseburg, Oregon, 97471. The project will include spreading wood chips and pulling weeds. Please wear sturdy shoes, weather-appropriate clothing, and bring gloves, rakes, and shovels if you have them. But there will be some available at the location if you don't have any. Saving Grace usually has coffee and donuts in the morning, and water will be available. To volunteer, or for more information,
email robin@umpquawatersheds.org.
That's R-O-B-B-I-N at umpquawatersheds.org. Or call 208-365-1789. Another upcoming opportunity is the U Creek Youth Campout on June 24th through the 26th. This fun summer weekend adventure is filled with science and outdoor activities for local youths, ages 12 through 17, and their families. At least one adult per youth is preferred, and limited space is available, so reserve early. This campout will include hiking, tracking, games, presentations, botany, ecology, astronomy, and more. If you're interested in leading an activity or signing you and your children up for this campout, email me at viviana@umpquawatersheds.org. That's viviana@umpquawatersheds.org. If you can't make the U Creek Youth Campout, we're having another youth campout at Twin Lakes on July 22nd through the 24th.
If you're more interested in a non-overnight activity for younger children, join us for Kids for Nature from June 20th to August 16th, Mondays and Tuesdays, except for the week of the 4th of July. This fun activity for elementary-age children includes fun art and educational activities. If you're interested in signing up your young one or attending yourself as an activity leader, you can also email me at viviana@umpquawatersheds.org.
If you love to read and would like to discuss environmental topics with fellow bookworms, try Turning Over a New Leaf Book Club. Turning Over a New Leaf Book Club meets over Zoom every other month and will next meet on Saturday, May 28th. The book to be discussed will be Finding the Mother Tree, Discovering the Wisdom of the Forest by Suzanne Simard. All sessions take place virtually at 5 p.m. on their date. For more information, please email Umpqua Watershed's Director of Education and Outreach, Ryan Kincaid, at her email, ryan@umpquawatersheds.org. That's ryan@umpquawatersheds.org. Or, if you'd like to share your environmental knowledge with the community by being interviewed for an episode of Living Downstream, email me at viviana@umpquawatersheds.org. That's viviana@umpquawatersheds.org.
I was wondering too, you mentioned that some species have gone extinct, so there aren't any images for those. Are there any limitations or restrictions on collecting certain types that may be endangered or very limited in quantity in existence now?
Yes and no. If a species is listed on the National Rare and Endangered Species List, you may not collect that plant on federal land. So any land owned by Forest Service, BLM, Park Service, places like that. The state of Oregon also maintains a rare and endangered plant list. It includes all of the federal endangered plants, as well as other plants that the state considers endangered in addition to the feds. And you cannot collect those plants on any land that the state owns or other government agencies within the state. So you couldn't collect them on county land or city land, for example. Any plant that is growing on private property, you can do anything you want with, believe it or not. So yeah, there's, what's that phrase I've heard used? Shoot, shovel, and shut up about endangered species. If you find an endangered species on your land, just get rid of it because you don't want it there, because that might mean you can't do what you want with your land. That may apply to animals. I'm not an expert on animals, so I'm not going to go there. It does not apply to plants. If you find an endangered plant species on your land, there is absolutely nothing anyone can do to you. That plant is yours. You can go out and stomp on it if you want. I don't want you to. Please don't do that. But you can legally do that, and there is nothing anyone can do to you. So if you do find an endangered plant species on your land, I would encourage people to take stewardship of it. It's yours. It is legally your plant. And I hope you will consider yourself lucky that you have that plant, that you own that plant, and that you'll protect it and take care of it.
I was wondering too, and you mentioned about taking data or collecting data from different sources. Is there an opportunity for the public to engage in something like a citizen science? Like, are you connected to, you know, something like iNaturalist, or how do people submit data?
But like I said, we have, in addition to the 250,000 and probably another 250,000 for other area, we have probably like 500,000 data points from just people who have given us their data. If people have a list of all the plants on their property, they can send that list to us and we will enter that data and it will get mapped. If you have good photos of a plant, we will happily accept those and crop them, do what we need to do to make them presentable and put those online as well. iNaturalist, yeah, that name comes up a lot now. And I like iNaturalist. I honestly do. I give iNaturalist all the credit in the world. They have brought citizen science. They have made citizen science a word people now know, or a term people now know about. And they've brought a lot of people into the world of science. And for that, just I give them two thumbs up. That's a fantastic thing. The only problem with us importing data from iNaturalist is that it's not curated. And we don't know how to curate it, because it comes from so many different people. It's hard for us to filter out the good versus the bad data. But again, I'm not saying any of this to disparage iNaturalist. I want people to use iNaturalist, and I would encourage them to do so. It's just right now we're not, it's information that we can't currently use. In the future, I don't know what form iNaturalist is going to take in the future. Yeah. What iNaturalist is today is not what it's going to be in 5 years. I can almost guarantee you that. What I would love to see from iNaturalist is maybe some form of curation, or just trusted individuals, or data that has been curated at least not long after it's been entered. They have that to some extent right now, but it's kind of hit and miss. Perhaps if that improves in the future, we'll be able to use iNaturalist data. But right now, no. We're still relying on just individual botanists to give us their data.
Yeah, I was thinking if someone wanted to submit information directly to you or Oregon Flora, how would they go about that?
I just go to our website. A few clicks, you'll see who to send the information to. Our main email address is oregonflora@oregonflora.org. And you can go on there. You can find my email address easily enough. You can send it to me and I'll happily take it and talk to you. And I do all the time. I spend a lot of my time. My main job is to compile and edit the flora of Oregon. And I also do a little bit of writing for it as well. I've authored a fair number of treatments within the two volumes we've published so far. Mainly, I take treatments. A treatment is a section of the flora. A treatment is what one expert has written about that particular group for the flora. And I edit their treatments. And I haven't counted up how many different authors we've had. Everybody writes in a different style. It seems like a different language sometimes. And I try to hammer them all into a similar format so that the book has a consistency from one page to the next. And so that's my main job. And I also answer lots and lots of emails from people just sending me a photo of something saying, hey, what is this? And those are great. I get a kick out of those. Some of them are super interesting. Often it's just something weird. And yeah, I love the weird stuff. But also emails of like, hey, you know, I have this plant list for, you know, this wetland I have on my property. And are you interested in it? And my answer is always yes, absolutely.
That's great. Yeah. I keep thinking of so many things that I want to discuss. You might have already mentioned this, but do you know how many species have been identified in Oregon, and are like, how often are new species found or added? Or is it, this is like a compound question, but is it more that the way we're identifying them and, you know, like differentiating them changes? So maybe it's not something new to science, but it's, you know, identified in a different way.
Yeah, yeah, I think, I mean, before we started recording this, I mentioned that I, in addition to my job here at Oregon Flora, I also teach part-time at Oregon State University. I recently did an entire lecture on this for my class to answer that question, but I'll try and give you the short version of it. It seems like a simple question, but it's actually fairly complicated. Right now, I'll give you a rough number. There's a little over 4,000 types of plants in Oregon that we know of, and that number changes about on a weekly basis. Well, that might be a slight exaggeration. I don't know. It varies from year to year. It varies from month to month. Some weeks, you know, we'll get like, you know, 10 different changes or additions, and then we'll have 3 weeks of nothing. So changes to the flora occur for a number of reasons. The first and most obvious reason is a plant species is introduced into the state. There's the grasses, for example. There's many, many grass species that have just come into the state from outside of Oregon. It just happens. I mean, you know, we're humans are a mobile species, and generally, not always, but generally, we don't introduce things on purpose. They just hang on us, or they stick to our cars or our shoes or in hay bales or what have you. So every year, yeah, there's always some species that are just introduced accidentally. There are some species that were at least quasi-introduced on purpose through gardening or cultivation because somebody thought it was pretty. It's gone now. They extirpated it. But people were worried about kudzu years ago. Kudzu did grow in Oregon, believe it or not. But the state weed people thankfully jumped on that and got rid of it, and it's gone now. Other introduced species, cheatgrass. I wish somebody had taken that much initiative when that thing was first found in the state. So that's the first way things change. The second reason is our understanding of what a particular species is changes. Sometimes, generally, an expert in a particular group will look at a species that was thought to be just one species. And they'll go, wait a minute, no. If you really look at this thing, the plants on, say, this side of the Cascades is actually one species, and the plants on the east side of the Cascades are actually pretty distinct. So that one species will become two species. And that changes the number of species we have in the state. And so those are the two biggest reasons. And the combination of the two keeps us on our toes. We have to keep track of that. And there's no central place where all this information goes to. It just pops up in dozens of different sources that we have to keep track of. And it's challenging.
What are your goals or the organization's goals for the compendiums? You mentioned that you're going to have three compendiums that are going to be printed. Like, where would those be, I guess, housed, or how would the printed versions be utilized?
So the two volumes are done. You can buy them either directly through our publisher, which is BRIT Publishing, B-R-I-T, which is an acronym for the Botanical Research Institute of Texas. There's a link to it on our website. You can buy it directly through them. They're on Amazon. Some bookstores carry it, and the third volume will be no different. Once the third volume is done, we're thinking about what we're going to do next. I'm probably going to take a long vacation first, because it's very tiring. So we're a small organization, and none of us are officially full-time. We're four people who are paid a part-time salary. And I think we're four people who work full-time as well. So in addition to holding other jobs, I also do some adjunct teaching at Oregon State University to kind of piece together a full-time living. And I've been at this. I've worked for Oregon Flora since 2010. Linda Hardison, who is the director, she's been here since the very beginning. And I have two other colleagues who have been here since before me. I think they started in the early 2000s. And it's been a labor of love. We do this, we don't do this for the money, believe me. We do it because we believe in the mission. And we want to see this through to the end. And when I say the end, I mean the publication of these three volumes and have the website in the best shape it can be in, and having the most information we can have on it. We actually are doing other things. We also have an app you can buy. It's called Oregon Wildflowers. It's $10. It's not comprehensive for the state, simply because of the limitations of a phone. When we designed this app, we did not want you to be dependent on a connection, either internet or just a standard phone line. So when you download this app, all of the data is in your phone. You can use it whether your phone's connected to anything or not. And we've got, I believe, over 1,000 species in it right now. And it has what's called a multiple entry key. So normally in a flora, you use a dichotomous key. A dichotomous key works by, you're asked two questions. You know, is this plant, for example, 1 to 10 centimeters versus over 10 centimeters? You pick one or the other. And then you're asked a series of two questions until you finally come to an answer. That's a dichotomous key. Multiple entry key, you're presented with multiple questions that you can answer or not answer. For example, in our app, if you have a plant and you don't know what it is, you open up the app and you have a variety of things you can pick to pin down what that plant is. What color is the flower? Where did you collect it? What time of the year is it? Is it a bush or a shrub or a vine, etc.? And you just put in as much information as you can. And it will pin that over 1,000 species down to, you know, in theory, one. In practice, you bring it down to a manageable level, say 30 species, and then you can hit this button and it will just show you pictures of all the 30 that fit that criteria. And then you do what's called picture keying. Just look at the pictures and see which one it is. And we're also in the process of developing a bigger and better version of that for our website. We're collecting a lot of morphological data. You can't use the same characters for every single plant. What works for a tree is not going to work for, say, a fern or an aquatic plant. So we need a lot more data, and we're in the process of collecting that now. And we have collected it for some major, major plant groups like the sunflower family and the grass family. We're in the process of doing the mustard family. We completed Fabaceae, the pea family recently. So we're eventually going to have good detailed morphological data for every species in the state. And then our next goal is to create that giant multiple entry online key for the state, which will be, I think, if we get it done in any kind of a timely manner, I hope will be the gold standard that other places in the country will look to and want to use. So.
That's great. Yeah, I feel like it's so helpful to have those resources available to help people, you know, I feel like people get so curious, you know, either what's on growing on their own land, or they go on a hike and they're wondering what type of species it is they saw.
Mm-hmm. I should mention, this goes back to Scott again, and Oregon Flora, it's not our motto, it's more of our creed that we don't believe that information should be hidden away. This is not a cold ivory tower academic endeavor. Any information we have, we want to share free. And I emphasize free. Okay, yeah, the app costs $10. Again, we're not making any money with that. The people who actually took care of the app and did all the technical stuff, the $10 goes to them. The university also takes a cut. And the same with our books. I mean, our books obviously aren't free. But yeah, my old Kia with bald tires is a testament that we're not making money from this. So at best, we can break even. We generally lose money on everything we do. And we want it that way because we want to give, the website is totally free. Okay. The website is completely free. We want to give the public, we want to give the people of Oregon, as well as people outside the state of Oregon, the information we've collected, either free or at small a cost as we can manage. We don't want to hide it. We don't want to be gatekeepers of any information. We don't want to censor anything. We believe knowledge, any knowledge, belongs to the people.
Yeah, I was thinking too, though, I was looking at the website actually recently, and I think I saw that there's like a native plant selector. Also, you mentioned about, you know, sometimes people not always intentionally will kind of bring, whether it's, you know, on their clothing or just their planting things. And so in some invasive species and sometimes harmful non-native species are coming to the state. And so it can be really important to select native species to try to reduce that if there are harmful effects. So I guess just what other features are on the website in addition to the native plant selector that you might want to point out to our listeners?
Yeah, gardening with natives, using natives in restoration projects has become very big recently, which we're happy to see, particularly with native gardening. And that's harder than you might think. Generally, you just can't go down to, well, I know you can't go down to Home Depot and find native species. That just is not going to happen. There are more nurseries, small nurseries, local nurseries that realize that people want native species to use in their gardens to landscape with, for any number of reasons. First of all, just to kind of put back these species into the wild. I mean, we've taken so much habitat from them away. People want to put as much back as they can. And that's great. It's a very noble endeavor. But it also goes beyond that. There's been a lot of interest in recent years in pollinators, bee species, insects such as that, particularly the native insects who are adapted to the native plant species, which there are fewer of. So in addition to people wanting to plant native species just for the plant's sake, this is also helping the insects. And And nature, there's just a chain effect with everything. By putting native plants out, you're helping the insects, and that spreads throughout the ecosystem. And we have a separate section on our website devoted to this, where people can go in and find what species are best for where they want to live generally, or where they want to plant them generally, where they live. I'm here in Corvallis, in the Willamette Valley. Things I plant here are not going to be the same things you plant down, I assume you're in Roseburg. Well, there's going to be a slight overlap, but there's going to be big differences. And so just because something is native to, say, the state of Oregon, doesn't mean you should plant it anywhere in the state of Oregon. You have to put some thought into it. And we're trying to help the public with that quandary. And I hope we're making some headway with that. So.
That's great. Yeah, we've been organizing various like panel discussions and whatnot. And one of our future panel discussions will have to do, we're thinking hopefully this summer that will happen, is on the impacts of climate change on pollinators and other insects and whatnot. Yeah, I'm thinking about how, you know, some flowers, because of changing climate, some flowers are blooming earlier at a different time or something like that. And sometimes either certain pollinators or maybe birds that eat them are traveling at different times. And so there are so many, like you're mentioning, so many just kind of interconnected changes and challenges that are going on. So yeah,
that's actually one thing I think that Scott never thought of when he first started this. I mean, 94, there were some people talking about climate change back then, but it's really come into its own relatively recently. And our data is being used because we have such good and such, again, I'll emphasize, accurate data. People can track when things are flowering. Has that flowering time changed? And additionally, where are the plants growing? Are they migrating? And plants do migrate. They don't migrate as fast as animals, obviously, but they do migrate in response to temperature, moisture, factors such as that. So our data can be used, and we'll give it away freely to anybody who wants to use it to see if the plants are responding to what is going on climatically.
I was just going to say, I guess, yeah, before we wrap up, is there anything else that you'd like to share either about the website or about, you know, Oregon Flora's work or ways that the public can get involved?
Well, of course, you know, buy our flora. It's, you know, it's not cheap. The first volume is 75. The second volume is 85. Buy it, use it. It might seem a little overwhelming at first if you've never used one, but you'll get the hang of it pretty quick. More than anything else, go check out our website, oregonflora.org. If you only want to look at the pictures, that's fine too. You know, if I weren't in my position, if I were just go back before I really, really knew much about botany. You know how sometimes you get into this rabbit hole when you're watching YouTube or something, you just keep, or Wikipedia. I've done that before. It's like you keep jumping from article. I would have done that with our pictures of the plants on our website. I would have just kept looking at more and more pictures. You know, we do curate the pictures and we put our best ones in the front. And some of them are, well, a lot of them are really, really amazing. I think you're going to be not just entertained, but without realizing it, learning something about plants, just looking at the photos on the website. And once you've done that, you know, then you can look at whatever, all the other things we have on the website and you'll walk away knowing a little bit more about plants and liking them more. And when that happens, you've made my day. I that's why I get up in the morning.
Well, thank you so much for being on our show. And yeah, people, hopefully everyone who's listening will check out the website and appreciate all that Oregon has to offer.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.